Hello, John Dennis here. It's Monday, November the 24th. Today, faced with a deepening economic recession, Alistair Darling announces one of the most important changes to the tax system since Labour came to power 11 years ago.
What Brown wants to do is come out at the end of this on top, making David Cameron and George Osborne look foolish. And what David Cameron and George Osborne want to do is to say to voters, look, he's bribing you with your own money. It's not going to work. Taxes will have to go up afterwards.
Also today, protests in a Derbyshire village against plans to develop a new open-cast coal mine, one of 58 proposed for the UK.
I just feel that coal is an outdated resource. I think we should be looking to the future, and I don't feel that coal is our future.
And a bitterly contested election campaign on the Channel Island of Sark.
We've had telephone calls from Moscow, Australia, Argentina, Italy, France, you name it. And I think we're going to get a great deal of the world's press on or around the election date.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, today's news and a flick through the papers with Sandy Waugh.
The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, will announce that a top rate of tax for people earning more than £150,000 a year will be brought in after the next election. It'll be at 45 pence in the pound and is aimed to help pay for the tax cuts the government wants to bring in now to counteract the recession. In his pre-budget report to Parliament today, the Chancellor will cut VAT by 2.5%. He hopes that'll encourage shoppers to keep buying. Mr Darling's also expected to give a tax rebate to people on low incomes and to freeze the planned increase in car tax. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors says more than 250,000 jobs could be lost in the construction industry because of the recession. New orders have fallen by a third and the situation could get worse, warn the surveyors. They've called for planned building and infrastructure projects to be brought forward. Meanwhile, the Business Secretary, Lord Mandelson, will tell the CBI annual conference that manufacturing is central to our economy. The US government's decided it has to bail out another troubled financial institution, Citigroup. The company's shares have plunged, and last week it announced tens of thousands of job losses around the world, including Britain. The US Treasury will put $20 billion into the firm and guarantee $300 billion of mortgage loans. In exchange, the government will insist on no pay rises for executives and help for people having trouble paying their mortgages. The incoming President Barack Obama will have to bring in a massive project to stimulate the US economy, his advisers have said. He'll also increase taxes on the rich, but more important will be spending billions of dollars on new business projects to stave off deflation. In other news, police are to buy 10,000 more tasers to be used by frontline officers. About 30,000 officers around the country will be trained to use them. The pop singer Michael Jackson will not now be coming to London to give evidence in court in his own defence. He's made an out-of-court settlement with a Bahraini prince who was suing him for more than £4.5 million. Only The Guardian and The Times managed to get the Chancellor's new tax on the rich on its front page. The Times warns that borrowing will still have to soar. The Mail and The Telegraph both talk about the Chancellor's gamble, though they differ about the figure for tax cuts. £20 billion, says the Mail, while the Telegraph goes for £16 billion. The Independent says it'll cost £200 billion of borrowing. The Financial Times says the country will be urged to shop its way out of crisis. The tabloids choose Gordon Ramsay for their front pages, with pictures of him with his wife. The chef's been accused of a seven-year-long affair, but the couple have announced they will stay together. On the back sports pages, there are only some pictures of Ricky Hatton after his boxing win. More favoured is yet more about Arsenal's one-time captain, William Gallas. "I need you, Gallas," says the Mirror, telling us that the footballer will get his place back for the Champions League match against Dinamo Kiev. It's his Gallas' last chance, scoffs the Sun. More news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
A package of tax cuts worth up to £20 billion is being announced today by Alistair Darling in his pre-budget report. At the centre of the Chancellor's bid to fight off the economic recession is a reduction in VAT from 17.5% to 15%. It's one of the most important statements on public finance that Labour has made since it won power in 1997. Our political commentator Michael White explains what Gordon Brown's fiscal stimulus is expected to consist of.
Chancellors, if they've got any sense, and Alistair Darling has lots of sense, normally keep something in their back pocket to surprise us all, to generate more headlines. And he's had a run of fairly positive headlines in the last 24, 48 hours. We are pretty confident that VAT is going to be cut from 17.5% to 15% for at least a year. Then it'll go back again. And the idea behind that is to sort of give a sort of cash stimulus almost to the economy. It's worth about $12 billion in lost taxation. The idea is that feeds back into the economy in different ways and gives a sort of short, sharp, shock to stimulus to consumer spending and other forms of expenditure, you know, a bit like plugging you into the mains for depression.
The government's critics are saying that tax cuts funded by extra borrowing now will inevitably lead to tax increases in the future. How do Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling answer that?
Well, they say that we're in a desperate situation in the Western economy at the moment, and we need to, not just the Western either, we need to stimulate economic growth to stop a number of things happening, to stop the slide into a recession, stroke depression, like the Great Depression of the 30s, to help free up the banking system and restore confidence in the system, and also to fend off deflation. All my lifetime, we've worried about inflation when prices go up and up and up year after year. But deflation is much nastier.
What will he be hoping to achieve politically by today's announcement?
Well, the odd thing about this financial crisis as it's developed is that, as it's got worse, that Brown's political fortunes have been restored. And my three ha'porth would be to add, I don't think he's going to call an election. He went on to the Jeremy Vine show on Friday and dismissed such talk. I'm 100% concentrating on the economy. One of my friends, who sees him quite a lot, sent me a text message to say, I hope you noticed that, Mike, that he means it. And I don't think there will be an election in 2009. I don't think it would be appropriate either in the crisis we're having. What Brown wants to do is come out at the end of this on top, making David Cameron and George Osborne look foolish. And what David Cameron and George Osborne want to do is to say to voters, look, he's bribing you with your own money. It's not going to work. Taxes will have to go up afterwards. Well, of course, they're right about that. But better to have higher taxes than a global depression.
Michael White, and there's full coverage of the pre-budget report today at guardian.co.uk/politics. Well, the fiscal stimulus announced by Mr. Darling is also the subject of a speech by the Prime Minister today. He's addressing business leaders at the annual conference of the Confederation of British Industry. Gordon Brown's expected to point to Barack Obama's plans for additional fiscal stimulus when he takes office early next year, as evidence that other world leaders are planning to boost their economies in a similar way to Britain. At the weekend, Obama laid out plans for a two-year economic stimulus package. He warned of mass unemployment and deflation if he didn't take swift action.
We have now lost 1.2 million jobs this year. And if we don't act swiftly and boldly, most experts now believe that we could lose millions of jobs next year. Now, there are no quick or easy fixes to this crisis, which has been many years in the making. And it's likely to get worse before it gets better. But January 20th is our chance to begin anew, with a new direction, new ideas, and new reforms that will create jobs and fuel long-term economic growth. I have already directed my economic team to come up with an economic recovery plan that will mean 2.5 million more jobs by January of 2011.
Ewan McCaskill's in Washington for The Guardian. Ewan, how does Obama plan to create 2.5 million jobs in the space of a year?
Well, he's going to do it in two ways. One is he's going to go for a sort of Roosevelt New Deal style rebuilding of the infrastructure. America's infrastructure is in a complete mess, as anybody who's been here recently will know. The bridges, the roads, the sewage haven't been touched for decades and they're falling apart. So, you know, a program like that will inject lots of new jobs. He's also keen on lots of energy efficiency and alternative fuel projects, and he wants to see a lot of the money going into those kind of jobs. So it's a combination of the two. It will be an enormous injection of cash. Obama hasn't mentioned, put a figure on it, but they're talking about $500 to $600 billion. dollars, and that's on top of the $700 billion bailout of the financial system. So it's a massive undertaking.
And today, the president-elect is naming his economics team, and we know some of them already, don't we?
Well, the names have been around for the last few days. Obama's team confirmed the names. Tim Geithner will become Treasury Secretary, and Larry Summers will take over as the White House economics advisor. So what Obama will be doing today is making their formal announcement. They're both regarded as sort of middle of the road, sort of center-right figures, pragmatic. Larry Summers served in the Clinton administration, so you know there's still sort of strong ties. I mean, a lot of the Obama appointments so far have been Clinton people, and this is another example of it.
Obama was elected, of course, on a tide of hope for change and the promise of change. Do his appointees so far leave those people, the people that voted for Obama, wanting change, feeling that that's what he's going to deliver?
Well, there hasn't been much dissent, at least in public, that from the Obama people so far. The argument that Obama's people, like guys like David Axelrod, the strategist, they say it's like putting a new coach in charge of a team. The new coach, the new manager, you might have the same old players, but you've got a new guy at the top, so you can head the team off in whatever direction you want.
Meanwhile, Ewan, George Bush is off on his last foreign trip to Peru. What's he doing there?
Well, it's the meeting of the Pacific Rim countries, and that brings in China, Russia. So it's quite a high-powered summit. What's interesting, over the weekend, when he sort of met Hu Jintao and the Canadian leader, Stephen Harper, and others, was he was in a really nostalgic, sort of wistful mood. There was a sort of sense that he was saying his goodbyes to them. He was leaving the international stage, telling them it would be the last time he would see them as president. And also a bit reflective, you know, this isn't a president normally given to reflection, but he's talking about his time in office the last 8 years and making jokes about his forced retirement on Obama's inauguration day on January 20th.
Ewan McCaskill's in Washington, and there's full coverage today of Obama's announcement of his economic team at guardian.co.uk/America. Also on The Guardian's website, after a raft of job cuts on Fleet Street, Peter Wilby argues that we have a long road to travel, even at the independent newspaper, before we discover how few journalists are actually needed to produce a newspaper. Have your say at mediaguardian.co.uk. Tanya Gold tries haggling for everything from bathroom cleaning products to double beds. You can find out how she got on at guardian.co.uk/G2. And Jarvis Cocker is interviewed by Simon Hattonstone at guardian.co.uk/art. Increases in the price of coal have led to the most rapid expansion of mines in the UK for 40 years, including 58 new or enlarged open cast or surface mines. These are much cheaper than deep mines, but local people face years of pollution. In the village of Smalley in Derbyshire, UK Coal is about to spend 4 years slicing out 1 million tonnes of coal. But as UK Coal's lorries prepare to roll in, opponents of open cast mining have vowed to dig in, as Martin Wainwright reports.
That's a blackbird singing in Old Pit Lane, Smalley in Derbyshire, in the old coal mining district of Derbyshire, where I've come to have a look at a controversial open cast mining scheme. It's one of an increasing number that have been given planning permission in Britain, and there's concern about how far this new open casting and the coal it's extracting are going to add to the country's carbon footprint. Would you mind telling me what you think about the open cast mining?
I just feel that coal is an outdated resource. I think we should be looking to the future, and I don't feel that coal is our future.
Is it that side of things, you know, and the carbon footprint and probably what your children learn about at school now,
yeah,
rather than the actual effect on the countryside here? Or is it a combination of the two?
Well, for me, having young children, it's a combination of everything. We're living right in the middle of it. We have one lorry every 4 minutes, literally past our front house, which is a metre from the front of the...
Yes, and they're big lorries, aren't they?
They're big lorries. So there's the air pollution, there's the visual pollution, there's noise pollution. I just feel it's not a forward thinking, forward-looking way that this country should be going. I do realise there's a lot of people, and alternative energy sources aren't necessarily the complete answer.
Well, I'm just making my way along the road back to Hina. Along there's a row of houses that overlook what could be the next stage of the open casting. I'm just knocking on doors at random, so thank you for answering.
We're worried about it because obviously it I'm told there'll probably be a 30-foot high wall of soil and, you know, at the bottom of our back garden, and obviously, you know, it'll ruin the view, sort of thing.
Yes, because at the moment you've got a lovely view.
Yes.
I mean, it's really beautiful, that valley, isn't it?
It'll also knock a lot of value off our house if we're trying to sell a house.
I've just found a gentleman trimming his hedges.
My opinion, I mean, let him get it, like, that's me. I'm not bothered, like, we need the coal, don't we?
Mm.
But it would have been nice if they could have pitted it, like, and it had kept more folks in way, wouldn't it? Like?
It would. Yes, deep mining.
Yes.
I'm with Neil Padgett, who's one of the leading lights in the campaign to stop open casting in Smalley.
They're going to be here for 4.5 years, but UK Coal owns surrounding fields as well, which is called the Mead site. There's a further 3 million tonnes there, so we estimate they're going to be here between 15 to 20 years instead of the 4.5 years at stage at the moment. Once the machinery is here, I can't see them then pulling away from the site and leaving 3 million tonnes there.
What's it like living next to an open cast mine, or overlooking an open cast mine? What does it mean to you?
It's just the noise, the dust, the pollution, the amount of vehicles that's going to be going into the site, which is 120 a day, which starts in probably around about fortnight's time. We've got two local schools as well. We've got the Smalley Richard Endowed School that these vehicles are going to go past, also a preschool. So we're pretty worried on, you know, the vehicle movement on an already busy A608.
Now, you fought it all this time. Have you lost, or is the battle still underway?
The battle's still underway. We lost because the government let us down last time. We followed all the government guidelines, but the government then went against its own guidelines and let, you know, UK Coal in after the appeal. So it was Ruth Kelly, the Secretary of State, that really let us down. We thought we'd won it because Parish Council objected to it, Local Council objected to it, Council objected to it, and the residents objected to it. We met all the government guidelines, and in the end, the government went back on those guidelines.
Martin Wainwright reporting. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, cautious optimism from the National Gallery that it can raise the £50 million needed to keep Titian's masterpiece, Diana and Actaeon, in the UK.
To allow this to go, to leave the country, it would be like taking an act off a Shakespeare play.
But first, for the last 450 years, the tiny island of Sark has been a feudal state. It's the last in the Western world. But now, for the first time, a largely elected parliament is being formed. Steve Morris reports, 80 miles from the British mainland.
It's a lovely sunny morning on the tiny Channel Island of Sark. This is a wonderful remote place. Cars are banned. You get around on foot, by bicycle or tractor. The sea is beautifully clear. There's no street lights, so the nights are bright with stars. But it's not quite a place of tranquility at the moment. For more than 400 years, Sark has been a feudal state, the last in the West. It's been ruled by a feudal landlord, the seigneur, and a largely unelected parliament, the chief pleas, dominated by the island's landowners. That's all changing. Human rights laws are forcing Sark to hold its first democratic elections. 473 voters go to the polls in a few weeks' time. Overseeing the process is the island's judge, Lieutenant Colonel Reg Geale.
It's a historic occasion. The people of Sark went to an opinion poll in 2006, and by 56% to 44%, they voted to have a fully elected government. So the majority of people on the island who took part in that poll, and it was an 89.5% turnout, wished to have a fully elected government. They've now got that, and many people have said for many years that they wouldn't stand for election while there was such an imbalance between elected members and unelected members in chief pleas. And I'm expecting and hoping that many of those people who in the past said they wouldn't stand because of that inequality will now actually decide to stand for election.
And huge interest, not only from the UK and on Sark, but from around the world.
Yes, we've had telephone calls from Moscow, Australia, Argentina, Italy, France, America, you name it, Japan, and I think we're going to get a great deal of the world's press in Sark on or around the election date.
The process is not proving to be painless. Even here, politics is getting a little nasty. There are two main factions fighting for control of the parliament. On one side, there are the supporters of the Barclay brothers, Sir David and Sir Frederick, the super-rich owners of the Telegraph newspapers and the Ritz Hotel. They live on a craggy island close by and have been investing heavily in Sark, smartening up hotels, shops and restaurants. They've campaigned vigorously for the move to democracy. But a second faction is wary of these radical changes. Among them is Sandra Williams, one of those fighting for election.
I think there's a definite two sides about everything. I mean, I've lived here most of my life since I was five. People I went to school with, it's very sad to say that they will walk on the other side of the road to avoid having to speak to me. I have a job to do and I have an opinion, and I also believe other people have an opinion, but somewhere people have to get together and move towards what's best for Sark.
I'm Kevin Delaney and I'm the estate manager here for Sark Estate Management.
Which makes you really the man on Sark for the Barclay twins.
You're quite right. I represent Sir Frederick and Sir David Barclay's interests here on the island.
And you're going to be standing in this election?
I most certainly am. I'm looking forward to it.
So what issues are you going to be fighting on?
I think it will be framed around the economy, the benefits that we've brought to the island to date, which are full employment, which didn't exist before we arrived here. We've spent a lot of time refurbishing properties over the past 18 months. We've empowered a lot of young entrepreneurs to allow them to open their own businesses. And we have a lot of exciting plans for the island going forward.
Many on the island are sad that things are changing. Hotelier Elizabeth Paré still has a musket above the arga of her cliffside home. Traditionally, all landowners were obliged to own a musket so they could defend the island if attacked.
I really feel saddened that so many people want to change everything, and really all along I have never changed my idea. I feel that I just feel if something works, don't change it. Furthermore, lots of people that have come to Sark because they absolutely loved it, and then my goodness gracious me, they're the ones who want to change everything.
At his beautiful 18th century manor, complete with a watchtower so that signalling could take place between the island and Guernsey, the seigneur, Michael Beaumont, is in reflective mood.
I used to be the sort of chief landlord. All property on Sark is held from the seigneur. The seigneur holds the land from the crown, all the land from the crown, and the other landholders hold their land from the seigneur in sort of old Norman feudal system. That's all changed now. Now, when anybody wanted to sell a part of their land or do anything with it, they had to get my permission. That no longer applies.
So democracy is a good thing? It's a very broad question.
It's a very broad question.
On Sark.
With reservations, yes. Yes.
Steve Morris reporting. Now time for a listener's complaint about Hannah Poole's interview with Mick Hucknall that we included in Thursday's programme. A commenter called Get Off My Cloud posts the question on the podcast page at guardian.co.uk/guardiandaily. How about a more in-depth interview with a band that we actually like, please, such as Fleet Foxes? Well, Get Off My Cloud, each to their own, of course, but you're in luck. Anyway, go to guardian.co.uk/musicweekly and you'll find exactly that, an interview with Fleet Foxes. And don't forget, you can post a comment on any aspect of today's show at guardian.co.uk/guardiandaily. Now, a campaign to save a painting by the Renaissance master Titian for The Nation has until the end of December to raise £50 million. It follows a decision by the Duke of Sutherland to sell Diana and Actaeon. If they raise the money, the National Gallery in London and the National Gallery of Scotland will also have the option of buying a second painting by Titian, Diana and Callisto, for a similar price in 3 years' time. The paintings have been in Britain for more than 200 years and on public view at the National Gallery of Scotland since 1945. Diana and Actaeon is on display currently at the National Gallery in London until December the 14th, and that's where I went to meet Colin Wiggins, the gallery's head of education. He told me why we must keep Diana and Actaeon.
Relatively, it's not a lot of money. I just refer your listeners to, let's say, Jonathan Ross's salary. The thing is, we will have this picture forever. It's an investment. The money just doesn't, as public ownership, we're transferring £50 million into one of the greatest works of art on the planet. The investment, I think, is valueless. It's such a snip. The painting, were it to go on the open market, would fetch 3-4 times that amount.
And there's been this donation of £10 million boost towards the campaign from the Heritage Memorial Lottery Fund. What difference has that made to the campaign?
Oh, a great difference. We are delighted, beside ourselves with joy, because that's a huge chunk of £50 million. We were cautiously optimistic that we'd get to the £50 million. With that £10 million, of course, it just makes it so much easier.
A whole range of famous names in British art have supported the campaign, including Lucian Freud, Damien Hirst, David Hockney, Tracy Emin. What effect, is it possible to detect the influence of this painting on contemporary art?
Oh yeah, absolutely, because Titian, being one of the definers of world painting, every single artist since has to take account of him, consciously or subconsciously. I'll give you just one example. Alison Watt, who recently had an exhibition here at the National Gallery, was brought up in Edinburgh, was an art student in Edinburgh, would go in and look at this painting almost every day and really seriously engage with it. And the beauty of a collection like the National Gallery's in Edinburgh, the National Gallery in London, is that we are free.
Well, what do members of the public think visiting the National Gallery? Let's find out.
Well, I'm so happy I came, because I'd seen in The Guardian and other newspapers, I'd seen reproductions of it and thought, why spend all the money on that?
Well, now you're standing in front of it.
Yes, now I'm standing in front of it. I'm absolutely overawed by the artistry of it and the intensity in which the story, Ovid's story, of the myth comes across, very, very powerful, and it's made me think, yes, we should make sure these paintings stay in the country.
I've seen it before, yes, but you come back to a painting like this and you see something different every time.
Is it worth £50 million?
It's worth a great deal. I mean, if that's what they say it's worth, if that's what needs paying, I think it is worth it. It absolutely is worth it.
I've known it since I was a schoolgirl and feel very passionate about it.
And so you'll be very keen for it to stay in the country?
That's absolutely right. You know, I'll be heartbroken if it doesn't.
What is it about this painting for you that's so special?
Well, I think you can come back to it time and time again and feel uplifted and stimulated and stunned by such an amazing work of art.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a great painting. Like all Titians, yeah, they're great. I think it's well worth keeping it in the gallery, definitely.
Is it worth £50 million?
Yeah, absolutely. Spend less on bombs.
That's me reporting from the National Gallery in London. And don't forget, you can see Diana and Actaeon at the National Gallery until December the 14th. I'm John Dennis. Thanks very much for listening to today's show, which was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey.